Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive. We're waiting for our guest, Brother D. Shahid Kareem, from the New Haven Registrar newspaper, and also from Muslim Journal. He's a writer and a thinker. And if Brother D. Shahid Kareem is in the house, please press 1 on your phone, and you will be plugged in. We're waiting for him. Like make some announcements. The first Sunday in Chicago, yours truly, Imam Alfred, will deliver a major public address at Mosque's First Sunday. This is the historic institution established by Imam Wahabuddin Muhammad. It's a public address, not a ta'aleem. It's a public address, meaning we're addressing the public. Christians, Muslims, Jews, believers, non-believers, anybody that's in the public is invited, welcome, and expected. My address would be the continuation of a post-physical Imam W.D. Muhammad address, which I have been given, that started in June of 2009, the emergence of global man from nativity to the emergence of global man. We continue that lecture series for about the last 5 years. Well, we had addressed the subject, the emergence of global man, a reluctant witness. Sunday the 7th, God willing, that is inshallah in the Quranic language, we will address the emergence of global man, the committed witness. I'm expecting a great blessing from Almighty God and a great gift to give to you. From God, I don't speak of myself, I ask God to inspire me to teach you. And whatever message he gives, I'm waiting just as much as you are. I will prepare, but the address should be an address. Also, we'll be teaching on the, okay, well, I don't have to talk. We have our dear brother and dear friend, Brother D. Shahid Kareem, thinker, activist, from the Muslim Journal and from the New Haven Register. Welcome to Religion Means Alive. You got me scared now. I thought I had to go out and commit urban violence to find you, you know.
No, don't do that.
Where's his brother at? There he is. Thank you. Welcome to Religion Means Alive, Brother D. Shahid Kareem.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for having us on the program today.
I'd like you to open with an opening statement. I've been reading in the Muslim Journal where you were one of the first of our community to address the urban violence. You know, some have argued that we're worried about the violence on the popo, but I'm also worried about the violence being more likely to be killed from Ray Ray than we are from the popo. So I would like you to just give us an opening statement, and from there we will join by questions, and I will come back for further comments.
Okay. Well, I think social issues are very prevalent in our lives today and in our communities. And I think as responsible journalists, or at least black journalists, we have some level of responsibility and obligation to write about stories that capture, you know, our life and our community, whether good or bad. So media is an amazing platform for, one, activism, and it also amplifies the voice of the black community. I also believe that as our influence grows, I also think our level of responsibility should grow with it. So with that said, I want to talk, and that's my opening statement.
Well, I noticed you have been doing, you did a series with the Connecticut Police Department, the State Attorney's Office, and others on the proliferation of guns in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to get on what side I am on the gun issue, but it does seem to me that there's a big problem when an urban area is infested with guns, when in our own homes we have explosive disorders. We don't understand civility. It's very difficult for us to talk, and this is generational. So I want you to comment and kind of lead us through why this campaign as a journalist. I mean, you, I know you're comfortable. You're at one of the most standard newspapers in the United States of America, New Haven Register. You work with most of the journalists. Can you just sit back and, as the young people say, and chill and forget about these problems? What prompted you to begin to write about them, to be an activist about them, and to be an advocate?
Well, it's a critical issue for our community, particularly because people who look like me are being killed, and who look like you are being killed and murdered every day in our city streets. And I think for me as a responsible journalist, I think that we have that obligation to bring national attention to urban gun violence. Folks in politics and in government, they target mass shootings, and they label most of the time mass shootings as a mental health crisis. But like you mentioned, you know, what about a person's individual who, a young boy who has seen several of his friends gunned down in the city streets? He has those similar problems as well. So I think for us as journalists, we have to really look at it as an opportunity to write about our story, drive our narrative, and be able to bring attention to gun violence on a national level. Because that's the only way we're going to really be able to solve, or at least help solve some of the problem, is that we will hold our senators, we hold our congressmen, we hold our elected officials accountable for what they say they're going to do.
I'm also wondering, should we also hold our religious leaders accountable? Because despite the fact that 2 Chainz, Rick Ross, and Nicki Minaj have bigger congregations than we do,
mm-hmm.
They seem to be more relevant than what we're saying as religious leaders. But it seems to me that we should be putting not our 2 cents in, but our dollar bills in to the discussion. Why is the masjid so silent? Why is the church so silent? I mean, it seems to me as that preachers, we're constantly confronting this issue because we have to funeralize, janazarize our members. Most of them, maybe some of us Muslims are not as plagued by these problems. I think we are. Some would argue that we're not. But why are be more outraged? I get the elected officials. Politics pretty much reflect what goes on in the community. Why are we more outraged? Why aren't we more disturbed?
Well, I think locally, and I think on some national level, the churches are more involved with the protesting, I would say, of gun violence in urban communities or inner cities. I think the outrage comes where the lack of outrage comes from it being a normalcy in our community. And then folks are just numb to gun violence. You know, Ray been shot, Pookie got shot, his brother got shot. So it becomes a mainstay or something common within our community. I think for Muslims, Muslim leaders, I don't think that we are. I think one, we're so busy trying to keep our masjids going that we don't have the time to participate in larger community activities. And two, quite frankly, I just think some Muslim leaders don't believe that we're concerned. And that's particularly African-American leaders. There are not too many African-American leaders I know locally here in Connecticut who are out front or in the vanguard of protesting. There's an outcry. There's a press conference. You rarely see the Muslim community, you know, in the forefront of those efforts. And particularly when the Prophet said, "The best of you is the one who is most useful to society." So we have all these examples. We have everything in the Quran, but I don't think some of us just missed the mark when it comes to that particular role and responsibility that we have as citizens.
I want to commend, first of all, Muslim journalist, marvelous editor, Sister Aisha K. Mustafa. I think she was listening earlier. I hope she is listening now. But we want you to know we love you, and this is a great service. What I found really strange, this is pretty ironic, in the embryonic stages of Islam in America, when we had the Bible and the lessons, we were more active on the streets, and we turned a lot of ray-rays and poo-poo and po-po into human beings. And now some of them are lawyers, some of them are judges, some of them are physicians. But they were pooky. 50 years ago, they were pooky. We transformed pooky. It seems to me that we have the urban medicine, the medication, calling people back to their humanity, calling them back to pull their pants up, but calling them to their full-fledged humanity. And it just seemed to me we have missed the mark. As the kids would say, what's up with that?
Yeah. You know, that's a very interesting question. I think now social media and other forms of getting the message out to people has become the norm versus the door-to-door versus, you know, one-on-one method of speaking to people and actually trying to reach the people. I think also it's also the easy way out when you can post something on Facebook or post something on Twitter, Instagram, et cetera. And it's another avenue, but sometimes it could be the easy way out of really trying to connect one-on-one with people in the community. And I just think a lot of folks just don't have the time. Folks are busy. There are financial issues. There are a lot of issues, I think, that folks are dealing with, because these are some challenging times that we're living in. And I don't think the folks just don't have the wherewithal to actually be out in the community day in and day out, really trying to get the message to the people.
Yes, I think that's true. I want to move along the discussion prior to opening the lines up, and let's find out who D. Shahid Karim is. I read some articles in the Muslim Journal. I don't know, I'm sure they're true. Were you always a member of the community of Al-Islam? How did D. Shahid Karim evolve, or how did he become D. Shahid Karim?
Mm-hmm. I actually took my Shahada in 1995. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, under Imam Fahmy Sabri and his community in Baton Rouge. I was Catholic before I converted or reverted, or however you want to call it, before I took Shahada. I was Catholic. And I began to study Islam actually when I went overseas as a young boy. When I was 14 years old, my father, wife was in the military, and we had the opportunity to visit Naples, Italy. And during that time, we traveled a lot through different countries in Europe, and a lot of had a chance to study Islam. when I got back to America, it just kind of stayed with me. So I was 22 years old when I took the shahada, and I got married to my first wife in 1995, and I submitted an article. I called Sister Aisha and I asked her, what was the process of submitting an article to the Muslim Journal? And she said, well, just write it and send it to me, and we'll see if we can work it into the rest of the stuff that we have. And I did. And from there, I kept calling her and kept writing, and that's how I became, you know, a writer for the Muslim Journal. And actually, that was my start. Being professional with journalism was through Muslim Journal. If I didn't have that experience, I was writing for Muslim Journal, and Aisha covered me along the way, you know, with editing stories and showing me tips and techniques on becoming a better writer. I don't think I'll be where I am today. I give all the credit of my development to Sister Aisha and the Muslim Journal staff.
Did you attend college? You know, most people think Muslims, the general consensus is that Muslims all came out of prisons. What is your background? I know you were Catholic. What was your academic? Did you just drop out of high school? Or? Yes.
Well, how were you? I completed high school in 1992-93. In Jacksonville, Florida, and I enrolled, then I moved to Connecticut in 1999, and during that time I enrolled in Springfield College in Springfield, Massachusetts, so I completed, it took me 6 years to complete my bachelor's degree in human services, so I am a college graduate, and I am looking to pursue a master's either in journalism or community psychology. I'm not sure yet, but I am looking towards completing my
deal. I hope you will actually study both because okay. I think there's a connection. Community psychology is vital. You know, it has been argued, and I think it's a fair argument too, that gun violence, I don't say gun violence, I said violence, period.
Mm-hmm.
Or, as I would say, the absence of peace is a public health issue. And
yeah.
Since you're interested in the community mental health, and we know that there's been studies at the University of Chicago that has talked about the violence being an epidemic, even now a pandemic. You know, there could be a beep in New Haven, and following the migratory pattern of a certain ethnic group, that beef could end all the way up in Florida. The person migrates, they get mad with this person, they go to Florida, kill somebody, F kill somebody, somebody got dissed. So we're talking about a spiraling kind of violence. Plus, we haven't gone to the next piece, how violence is taught in the homes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the domestic violence,
yeah.
Both male and female. Or
yeah.
Even something deeper, the civility that happens in the homes.
Mm-hmm.
No discussion, that's what the mental health people call intermittent explosive disorder. I was explaining to a mental health person today, I said, in the African-American community, it's not intermittent. It seems to be compulsive explosive disorder. So talk with us about that and talk to us about how journalism can actually address that problem. But I want you to talk about the mental health piece because I think you've carved out a career, a double master's. I give you two homework assignments.
I appreciate that. Well, I think journalism can help in that area, really trying to focus on the issue at hand. And I think for our community, particularly African American community, you know, mental health is taboo in our community. It's something that, you know, we really don't want to talk about. That a lot of our kids, our youth, you know, they have mental health problems, and it could be from, you know, a variety of reasons or their, you know, circumstances. And I think journalism you know, journalism is the role of journalism is to be the watchdog, you know, of the community. That's the role and responsibility, to make sure that others are not mistreated. So I think that being the watchdog for the public, being a watchdog to make sure that corruption doesn't prevail, you know, is very, very, you know, important for that to be, you know, I would say, for that to be the main focus of why reporting is important for communities, particularly, you know, communities of color. So that's something that we really have to look at, that mental health piece, because it's become a crisis in our community, and if it's not addressed, you know, we'll still have that misplaced aggression. You know, we'll still have those problems of gun violence if it's not addressed. So I, you know, in New Haven, what we're trying to do in New Haven is try to get, you know, all of our mental health professionals together, and all of our people who are experts in the field of mental health, and really come together and try to figure out a way of how we help our children. We can't count on Yale. We can't count on Clifford Beard. We can't count on all these other organizations to, you know, really diagnose and assess our children. You know, we have to do that. And we need to make it a point that all the mental health professions in the Black community have to work together and really assess our own children, because that's the only way that we're going to really solve our problems, is that we're assessing it and that we deal with it.
And, you know, we talk very much in the mental health profession about the issues surrounding slavery. And I'm thinking of a great scholar that did his work out of New Haven, Dr. John Black McGain. Actually, he was from Louisiana. And he did a book called The Slave Community. And I think we are really failing to realize the effects of slavery. I mean, the people primarily in Connecticut, they were once in Virginia. They were once in North Carolina and Georgia, where there were poor treatment. So it's learned behavior coupled with the breakdown in the industrial life. Now they don't have any work. So this aggression, this anger. And I think we as religious leaders, mental health practitioners, in fact, Imam Muhammad was the one that turned me on to the mental health issue. Once he invited a group of imams to come to a psychotherapy center in New York City, try to get us to get into mental health. The imam brought that Imam Muhammad there very late, and I told the director, I said, you know, the problem is probably some of the imams thought they were going to be kept, so they didn't want to come. But I think that when we look at the African-American tradition, look at the Emmett Till, I remember your state that you were born in, Louisiana. I still can't pronounce Louisiana. I always say Louisiana because I think about the brutality of what happened to our people in that state, you know, in Plaquemine County. And that violence is still in the subconscious, it's not in the conscious. And it's acted out in these northern cities. Would you care to comment on that?
Now, what was the question again?
I was talking about learned behavior and violence. I want you to comment on trying to tease out this generational violence. You know, Pluky saw his mother smashed, and now Pluky smashes his mother. I mean, smashes his baby mama, and he hasn't gotten married. And now Pluky, 10, 20 years later, has a son, and Pluky Jr. is, you know, beating his woman up. So it's like a vicious chain. So I'm thinking all the way back to plantation life, how this chain hasn't been broken.
Yeah, I you know, from a media perspective, I think media fuels some of the violence within our community. I think the images that are portrayed in the media of young Black men, particularly being aggressive, and the stigma of Black inferiority is a major problem in media. So I also think that, you know, Black folks are, the Black community also fuse some of the racism and some of the stereotypes by posting you know, certain things on Facebook, you know, the hood fights and, you know, all this twerking and all this stuff that, you know, is negative, and it hurts our image as a community. And, you know, recently New Haven, the Law Center study released a report earlier this year in New Haven that pegged New Haven as the number two most dangerous community or city with a population under 200,000 in the country. Now, according to the FBI said that those numbers are inaccurate. So, but when you have media and these studies that put these numbers out in the community, listing New Haven as the number two most dangerous country, dangerous city in the country, you know, that you know, for some young black folks, that we take pride in that. We take pride being the most dangerous or one of the most dangerous cities in the country. So, you know, media has a way of perpetuating violence within the community, particularly entertainment media. That medium really hurts us. And because most young men don't know how to decipher for what's real and what's not real. So that really hurts us, man, more so than anything. Yeah, we have a problem with, you know, not loving each other. But when that's, you know, constantly, you know, put in front of us, we think that's what we're supposed to do, and that's who we are, and that hurts us a lot. So the only way that we can combat that is to work with families, is to work with one another in our community. We can't solve all the problems. We can't solve this issue of gun violence. We have to just do the best that we can with what we got.
So you're saying there's a lot of mythologizing around violence and Breaking Bad, and even the academic community has contributed greatly to this. I want you to talk now a little bit about, you know what, I just have to notice, there were several people listening. And when we have these kinds of discussions, a lot of our people just tune this out. And I would ask again, what's up with that? Why aren't we interested in even listening to these kinds of discussions? They just think that, I don't know, the Muslims think we should be here to talk about prayer. We're not talking about something from our perspective. I don't know what the rest of our people, I had to observe that, how our audiences sort of disappear when we have these painful discussions.
Well, I think there are some people in the country that are doing some phenomenal things trying to address, you know, gun violence. But I think for a lot of African Americans particularly, you know, they have their own set of issues. They have their own personal problems. They may have marital problems. They may have, you know, financial problems, something that we talked about earlier. But also those, you know, African Americans who have so-called made it, you know, came from the slums or came from the projects or the ghetto. Some feel that that's not their problem anymore, and they tend not to be bothered with you know, kooky and raving in them. So, you know, that's the issue that we have, because if you don't feel that it's a problem and you can do something about it, it also hurts our interest. So that's something that we really have to look at too as a community. And sometimes we can't count on certain people to help us. Some people just not going to help us. I think if we galvanize the good people and the sincere people who just want to help in this problem, dealing with gun violence, then we're on the right path and the right track.
Yeah, I agree with you. We have to get the committed and willing. We can't get those on. And I believe if we had demonstrations in these neighborhoods on a weekly basis and appeal to our young people, what the American Indians call, the Native American, I don't call American Indians, they call restorative justice. You know, I was speaking on a platform with a young man who spent 16 years in jail. And he said, look, I came back to speak in this neighborhood because I created a trail of blood. And he was there because he was really pained by, he said, many young people of following my legend. I was a legend, you know, Violet Virgil. And he didn't feel good about that, so he had gone back to the neighborhood to work to address those problems. And I had myself I'm sorry. Yeah, had an interruption. But I just think that it's that kind of well, I lost my train of thought when I was talking about because somebody knocked on the door. But yeah, I was talking about this young man with the restorative justice piece. I think that if we had more people who've gotten out of prison and now have turned our lives around, what they call, some people call them double, I guess, I don't know what they call them. These are guys who did life in prison. And now they're out. A lot of them are really pained by what they've seen. So I wanted to ask you, how can we use ex-offenders and preventing offense of this, how can they be utilized to fight this gun violence?
Yeah, they are a great resource, you know, for the community, and can be examples and role models for young people who are at risk of dipping straddling the fence, if we may say. They are a great resource and a great. To be great role models for the community. But I think the concern is that, you know, just for those brothers who are, you know, coming out of prison, well, they have a lot to deal with too. They have to deal with, you know, employment. They have to deal with coming back into the society, the culture shock, the different things that are happening in their environment, the influences, you know, and that whisper, man, that whisper is very, whisper is very enticing, and it's challenging because if you don't have any skills, all you know is what you know, and you resort back to that. It's a very challenging process for so-called ex-offenders. But if we had mechanisms in place as a community that could really assist ex-offenders, to actually get back on their feet, they could really help us change, you know, lives of young people in our community. But we have to have certain programs. And again, there are some programs, you know, throughout all cities that are really doing some good jobs. But if we really want to get to the root of our issues, we have to establish our own programs and our own agencies. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, what have you found to be the corporation of the Christian African-American clergy? How have they reacted?
To the gun violence?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, they're in New Haven, there are a lot of Christian leaders, particularly African-Americans, who are very active and have taken a large role with being a part of trying to stop some of the violence in New Haven. They opened their churches, for an example, they opened their churches for mentoring for young people. They opened their churches for substance abuse sessions that they did bring professionals in to their community to talk to men who have substance abuse problems and women too. So their doors are open with a lot of community activity that are really helping members of the community. But with some of the Islamic communities, for whatever reason, you know, most of our doors are not open, at least here in New Haven. I can't speak for any other city. I know here for New Haven, particularly, most of our masjid doors are closed. And for whatever reason, And we are not, you know, taking the opportunity to open our doors to really help our people to get back on their feet, because our folks are struggling. Hunger is, is pervasive. Homelessness is pervasive. Gun violence in New Haven is pervasive. So you have all these challenges in every religious community, particularly Muslims, would open their doors. I think we can really have an impact in our communities. And I don't know why.
I think you're also saying something, because the Muslims have had a long history of credibility in the streets. For whatever reason, many African American men, they may not be in the Islam, but they've been turned off to Christianity. So it's really an unfortunate factor that the Muslims haven't opened our doors. And I must unfortunately tell you that this is throughout the United States. I travel throughout the United States. I'm going to be in Memphis, Tennessee for the time to be grateful, God willing. And I've already asked some people in Memphis if they could facilitate my speaking to the African-American community in Memphis. They have violence everywhere we are. If you see Martin Luther King Boulevard or you see an African-American neighborhood, I was at Yale University in 2006, and I went over by where the Divinity School is. And I must tell you, I've grown up in the urban area. I was terrified right around the train station. You know, I saw people scoping and hoping and looking at me, and I said, wow, man. And I did give them the greetings. I salamu alaikum. They kind of kept them up off me, because there's still respect on the street for Muslims. But we don't seem to have not capitalized on that. And, you know, I want you to speak to this, because I heard Imam Muhammad, the last physical time I was with him was 2008 Savior Day.
Mm-hmm.
And he literally begged the Imam to open the doors of the masjid and teach our people. He said, they haven't had a chance. They haven't had an opportunity. We should give them our perspective. We see even in the prison system that they're getting a distorted version of Islam. You know, I mean, they're not getting the version that you got to go to school while you're there, get a program, get your GED, get a skill. So the poor brother who stayed 5, 6, maybe 10, 15 years in jail has come back really worse. He has witnessed violence. I'm going to shut up and let you reflect upon that.
The question is he, you said, is he worse? Is he?
My question is, more of a general comment. I said the brother, poor brother who has come through the correctional facility, has now come out in a worse position. I mean, because he hasn't been touched by any reform. Very few people finish school, some do. But I'm saying it was one time a guy went in and he was a Muslim. I mean, he wasn't a Muslim. When he came out, he was reformed because the Muslims had a reformation program.
Yeah.
You know, they insisted. I went to a program with an ex-prisoner who spent 30 years in the New York State Correctional Facility. And he talked about how he insisted that the young people there go to school, that they take advantage. He himself, while he was in prison, got a bachelor's and a master's degree. And it seems to me that kind of reformation is now gone from the, it's gone from the Muslim, from the Muslim prison program. So I'm just wondering, why is it that in the streets, I'm just thinking of people getting out of prison. I'm kind of channeling a prisoner getting out and not having any place really to go where he can get some guidance and direction.
Yeah. You know, I just think we hadn't done a great job at making a strong impact or presence in our communities. I think that's where we, as Muslims, fall short. We just hadn't made a strong presence, you know, in our communities. You know, most people know us because of longevity in our communities. But do they really know us? You know, what are we doing? What type of contributions, you know, have we made in our communities? And we just can't say that interfaith is a contribution. And that's one aspect of community life and community development.
Brother Zeed Saeed Kareem, if I were there, I could hug you. Because, you know, it just seems to me we think that's the only program.
Yeah.
And I think that's the easy route out. You know, you can go up to Yale, talk to a Unitarian, talk to a Buddhist. And really, they don't even have any hard discussions there. You know, we're not talking about the role of violence in the society. It's just a showing, puffery. But what about dialoguing with Ray Ray and Poo Poo?
Right.
You know, let's hear what Poo Poo's view of the world is. Let's have a dialogue with him. I mean, he has something to say. We may or may not agree with it, but, you know, really, I think our center should be opened up to offer GED literacy programs. You feed the homeless, educate people. That's what the Temple of Islam was about. It was a transformational center.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A man could come in Monday morning, I mean on a Wednesday, and Friday he's begun to throw away some drug habits, clean himself up, be turned around to go back to school, even if he didn't join us. It just seemed to me we have lost that kind of, as the French would call it, the raison d'être.
And it could be the leadership of our misogynists around the country, because they are experienced people who have expertise in mental health and in counseling and in community policing and all these various avenues of life. But sometimes their voices are hijacked. They're not able to express themselves in community life, in Islamic community life, and therefore they take their services elsewhere. There's a lot of Muslims, particularly in New Haven, who I know of who are experts in mental health and social work, et cetera. But because of personality issues, maybe, or issues that come up in our misogynists, they tend not to want to be bothered with, you know, the day-to-day operations of community. So we have that dynamic too as a big problem, and folks just take their services elsewhere, man. It is what it is. You know, that's the reality of the situation.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate reality. That's why we have this show. That's why we have this program. I call Religion Means Alive another brand, because, you know, I'm not knocking the other radio stations that they have out here. I'm not interested in talking to Muslims. I'm interested in talking to the public from a Muslim perspective. You know, I'm not going to be rubbing Al Sharpton. You know, I'm not Louis Farrakhan. I'm not any of it, but I have the concerns about people. I'm concerned about violence, period. You know, rapes. Nobody talks about rapes in our community. You know, and like I say, I'm noticing the board, we had about 20 people listening or more. Yeah, we don't know how many is listed by our browser, but most of the people just dropped off. So I'm going to work with what we got. We're looking to reach the concerned people. And, you know, if we keep talking about it, we're going to reach those people. But it is, I hate to say it, it's bad leadership. I know it didn't come from Imam Muhammad. I have found hardly any other imam have picked up this challenge in any city in the United States. None of them are talking to violence. In fact, some of them say we don't need to deal with that. I'm sorry. Brother D. Shahid, you just help me. I don't understand how they could say that.
I don't know. I just think that we, Allah say, you know, help those who help you and work with those who work with you. I just think that we have to work with those people who want to work with us, and just utilize our expertise in areas and avenues that we know that can make an impact, you know, in our communities.
I said that's what we're interested in doing. We can't work with the dead. We got to work with the living. Those who are interested in these kinds of concerns. And like I said, there's some who are not interested. You know, let's open the lines up. We're talking with Brother D. Shahid. Kareem of New Haven, Connecticut, writer, journalist, soon-to-be community mental health specialist that he's already operating. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's dial 805-727-7013, 805-727-7013. I want to take this opportunity to thank those of you who have donated to us. Religion Means Live. It's not a free program. Costs money to be on the air. We're going to Chicago for the first Sunday to be the guest of Mosque Cares. And we ask you to send your donation to Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. Also, some of you might know, I have contracted, or it contracted me, prostate cancer. I'm being treated. I'm being treated by integrated medicine specialist, and you can go to GoFundMe, Alfred Muhammad's Prostate Cancer Fund, so we can pay our physician. Unfortunately, the insurance companies don't pay for integrated medicine. They either want you to have radiation, they want you to have chemotherapy, or surgery. I'm not knocking anybody to get those. I would never tell a person what to do. But I can tell you this, I've looked at all of those as alternatives, and I found a physician, a board-certified physician, that's treating me. Unfortunately, he won't treat me for free. So if you can spare $10, $20, $30, whatever you can spare, we are raising money for treatment. Now, if you also want to contribute to this program, which costs money to be on the air, and for travel money for us to go back and forth to Chicago and other cities. We were just in Philadelphia this weekend. We're in Trenton, New Jersey. We were at the National Halal Conference in Philadelphia. We went over to a retirement party for, a 70-year birthday party for somebody who just recently got out of the hospital. So Religion Means Alive is on the move. When we had just on Saturday, we had Hinton Battle, three-time Tony Award-winning star on Broadway. Miss Dionne Warwick is slated to be on our program. Big Daddy Kane is going to be on the program, other people. And all of these people, we're going to talk about this urban violence. We are on this case. We don't call it urban violence. We call it the Urban Peace Mission. Because we think that violence is not necessarily peace. We want our people to learn to have peace. Peace within themselves, which is a mental health issue, a spiritual issue. But we also want them to have peace without. You know, I believe what I want to do is come to these cities and show our people how you can have a dispute without pulling your dukes out or going and getting your guns. When I was growing up, guys said, let's go outside. That means fighting. But today they don't go outside and fight. Today they go out with a bullet. And so I'm convinced that we have to teach our people the art of peace. I'd like you to make comments, Brother Deshai Kareem, on the art of peace and how you think we can help develop that in these neighborhoods.
Yeah, I think one of the ways we can develop that is just having these open and candid conversations within our communities. And those conversations begin to become healing mechanisms for us. I think we don't take time enough to have candid conversations within our community. And we need that emotional emancipation, healing. That's very important. I mean, just having this conversation now, every time we have a conversation, an enlightened conversation, it works at, healing ourselves. It chips away at whatever bad action, it chips away of negativity. It chips away all those things that we are dealing with. Not just having these open and candid conversations. I think once we have more of these conversations, we'll turn our community around. We can look at having a peaceful community.
that you have had the police. Yeah, I wanted to also ask you, I think what we need to do, I'm sorry you won't be able to be at the Muslim Journals Conference, because I wish we had an opportunity to bring all the concerned people like yourself who are interested in these kind of issues. This year at the Muslim Convention, the 2015 convention, the 26th annual convention, I'm going to convene a group around urban peace. And I hope you'll be there. It's going to be this year, 2015, in the Tinley Park Convention Center, Labor Day weekend, where we're going to get together to labor. And I'm hoping that we can have some strong resolutions and a strong plan and strategy. Because just like you said, we can't worry about people who don't want to do anything about it. But what about the community policing? What about the people who are doing security? What about the people who are in mental health? There are many thousands of people in our community who are concerned about these issues. So Imam Muhammad said before he passed, he said, jihad to what robber to, struggle and establish alliances. And that's why I was so impressed with reading your article. I said, this brother's out of my own heart. He didn't know he even stole my heart already. He got a nice smile. I mean, but he stole my heart because that's my concern. That's my passion. I don't want to see Pookie dead.
Right.
I'm tired of going to Red Ray's funeral. And I'm tired of also the hypocritical lying people from among us who are so concerned about Ferguson, Missouri, and the Popo killing us, but not concerned about Pookie killing us.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people I'm more worried about Ray Ray than I am about Ray Kelly's boys. Now, I got the police. I'm not minimizing police violence. But absence of the police, most of our communities would be complete chaos. I want you to talk a moment about proper policing. You've had an opportunity to discuss with law enforcement authorities, I think you're in the state. What is their view of this whole gun violence?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. I think that in New Haven, New Haven Police Department prides itself on community policing, and they have gone back to the old fashioned way of doing policing. You know, walking beats, really trying to have officers get to know residents in the community, and get to know young people in their communities, and the police officers have programs that they put on in the community to build trust among youth and among residents in the community, but there still is lack of trust between residents and the police department for a variety of reasons. You have the racial divide, the racial tension, and then you have black cops who use their authority to abuse young people in the community. So we have those issues. But there are some police officers in the city that are actually really trying to put their foot down and really do a good job and get a handle of this gun violence. And most of the, some of the police officers that I've come in contact with, that I know on a personal level, have become mentors to a lot of the youth in the city. But I think you have good cops and you have bad cops, and I think that's anywhere in our cities across America.
Yes, I agree with that. I agree. What about the roles of, I want you to share with us your conversations with the Muslims who are in mental health, and how they view this whole issue of how their religion influenced them to work in the field of mental health.
I have to be honest, I hadn't really come across a lot of Muslims who are in mental health, who are working with communities such as ours that deal with gun violence. And that's, I just hadn't had that experience to speak on that. So I'm not, I don't want to speak on something I haven't experienced on. So I really can't tell you that. I really don't know. But what I do know is that we've had some professionals, Muslim professionals, who have tried to establish the masjid or the mosque as a safe haven on mental health, used as a clinic or a place of resource to counsel folk. But sometimes it doesn't work because of personality clashes or because of other issues that are dealing that are happening in the community. And again, that hurts.
Can you share with us what some of those issues without being specific?
I think, you know, personality issues. I think status quo is the issue. I think power is the issue within our community, Muslim communities. I think sometimes when you have a professional who has a profession and who is a professional and works in that field, he may know more than the principal of the Claremont School. You know, he may know more than the security officer. He may know more than the imam. And I think sometimes we, because we have these roles in our communities, which are somewhat roles that are responsible. When we have professional people that can come in and really do a service to the community, but because of your role in the community, sometimes those people who are professional, they don't really want to work with people who are not professional. That's just how it is, man. You know, it's just where it is. So I would say, you know, status quo, you know, power, lack of professionalism.
I know you're a mental health professional, and I also know you are a businessman. But I also know that now you're very diplomatic, and we also have to give you a master in diplomacy because you're quite adept at diplomacy, and that's part of being a community figure. One doesn't have diplomacy. I do think down the road someplace, we're going to have to revisit those issues because they're a big issue for us all over the country. And the greater cause is being overlooked. I think the big problem in the Muslim community is we don't have a cause. Yeah. And our cause should be social reform. Our prophet was a social reformer. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad was a social reformer, and Imam Muhammad was a social reformer. So if we just here giving the word, and we say this is the religion, and all we can do is give a khutbah. But second thing I think is a big issue for us is forming, I don't like to use a lot of Islamic terms because my audience is primarily non-Muslim. And we find ourselves, we call it consultative. In the Islamic language, it's called shura, bainahum. Shura, consulting people among you. And we don't, most of these places, we don't even have shura about it. You know, what do I, mental health happened to be my field. I tell security people when I ride with them, I defer to you. I don't know anything about security. That's not my field. I have a scant knowledge of it.
Right.
I would defer to person more,
right.
I would defer to a person more senior than I. I think that's a big issue for us in the community, is that our leadership just doesn't know how to defer to those who have expertise.
Yeah.
Consequently, we have people who know how to wash dishes, baking a pie. Just because I know how to bake a pie doesn't mean I know how to wash dishes.
Yeah.
But we do need a pie maker. And it's so in the community life. I think the focus has been lost. I really, really, truly applaud this work you're doing. You were saying that when you were in college, you studied human services. What prompted you, Brother Deshae Kareem, to study human services? And also, while you're at it, would you share with us what human service, what that field consists of?
Yeah. You know, human service is a advocate field. It's a champion for citizen rights, you know, social rights. It's an advocate. So, you know, I wanted to be an advocate for the poor and disenfranchised. That's why I chose to go into the field of human services. And to be their mouthpiece, to be their voice, you know, for the community. And I use journalism as the opportunity to do that. I had to become educated on what are some of the social issues that plague our communities. And once I learned about the social issues, and of course there are many social issues that affect our community. But once I began to understand, you know, what was prevalent and what was some of the social ills, and I turned that into, I used journalism as a way to talk about it, advocate for victim rights, you know, to advocate for urban gun violence, to advocate for feeding the homeless, feeding the hungry, to advocate for the homeless. So, you know, human services deals with the advocacy part of society. So that's why I chose to be into human services.
Have you ever considered opening up a human service center with Islamic influence, and those of you who are similarly situated or perhaps even dissatisfied with the way the leadership is? Has that ever occurred to you?
Yeah, that has occurred to me, and that's one of the reasons why that I am pursuing my master's in community psychology, so we can have those facilities that are within our community, and that will serve individuals that have, you know, substance or mental health issues, and where people who look like us that are serving the people who are having the issues. A lot of times, young folks, when they have these mental health issues, mental health problems, these substance abuse, a lot of times they go to facilities with people that don't look like us. And that becomes a challenge. You know, it's a trust issue. And a lot of times folks are not willing to be as open to folks who are outside versus, you know, folks who look like them and who are in the inside. So absolutely, I have thought about that, and that's one reason why I'm pursuing this community counseling psychology degree.
Talk to us, what is community psychology? When we speak of community psychology, you know, I first worked at Harlem Hospital, one of my many jobs, was I worked in community psychiatry department. It was called Department of Psychiatry at Harlem Hospital, Division of Community Psychiatry. Share with us what community psychology is. How is that different from counseling psychology, or are they similar?
Well, it's similar. It's more so dealing with the dynamics of, you know, of community. You know, how a community operates. You know, what makes a community tick. You know, why do members of this particular society community, you know, does certain things, the idiosyncrasies, you know, the behaviors, you know, what makes, you know, what makes a group of young men become involved in gangs, you know, what makes a group of young females become involved in gangs, and how, as a community psychiatrist, how do we need to try to fix that problem so these kids won't, you know, be involved in these activities that they shouldn't be involved in. So that's pretty much, you know, what the community psychology piece is.
Yes. Now, What intervention tools can a community psychologist engage in? But prior to asking you that question, it seems to me that we need that kind of community psychology to, one, study how our community operates, and, two, to study the impediments. And, of course, I'm very interested in intervention. Share with us some of your ideas about these. You've been around, you've studied the Muslim community, you've been over the Muslim Journal, worked at the Muslim Journal. Just for a moment, tease out for us how a community psychologist would look at a community of Imam W.D. Muhammad.
I think one of the one would look at the community of Imam W.D. Muhammad as somewhat deteriorating. Unfortunately, it's deteriorating, and that may be a strong word to use. And I'm using that word because there is a lack of youth involvement and youth voices in our community. So when we look at our communities, when we look at the dynamics of our community, our Muslim community, we rarely see any young people within our community. And there's a variety of reasons, why that is. And I think that's something that we really need to deal with if we want to survive within the next 5 or 10 years. If we don't really get a grip on that, a lot of our communities are going to decline, and they're going to deteriorate. And that's what the immigrant Muslims are have reported. There's a report out. It's called the American Mosque 2011. The basic characteristics of the American Muslim attitudes of a mosque leader by Ishan Bagri. He put a report out back in 2011 of the findings from 2000 to 2010. And one of the things that he found in his report was that from 2000 to 2010, urban centers or urban communities are declining, and that most of African Americans who are now converting to Islam are more so converting in suburban communities versus urban communities. And if we don't get a handle on our youth, because, our propagation, our Dawah effort comes through propagation. Their Dawah effort comes through, immigration. So if we don't get a handle on having more youth involvement, having more youth in leadership roles in our communities, we're going to soon fade out if we're not already doing so.
Yes, I have. I agree with you 100%. I one of the reasons we have on our program every Sunday, if you listen, basically, we have two young people that generally address the audience. I made it insistent when I founded this ministry. Religion means alive, to involve people like Ismail Qadar, Imam Mujahideen, Muhammad, and others, and many other young people. We're involved in our youth hour every day on this program. I've involved my own children because I'm recognized this. I remember a time when I was a student at Hartford Seminary that was predicted in 20 years from, I think, around 19. I was there in 92, 94. They had predicted that Islam among the African-American community would be a majority Muslim community, particularly among the men. And now we all of a sudden we see that there is a decline. And what I'm also frightened by, brother, is that many of our bright young people are migrating to the immigrant masjid, where they have committees, where they have departments, where they feel that there's more adequate Islamization, even though I question Islamization and the Americanization process. But you know, you're right. Our centers are dying.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have any growth. You know, it seems to, and even the, in the prison population, they're dying. Because among the prison people, they're getting other influences. So, I mean, we need to sound the alarm. I think all is not well. I was at a beautiful facility in a city that will remain unnamed. And I was appalled by the poverty of attendance. You know, and I hate to say this. I'm not patting the Nation of Islam on the back. I don't. I know they don't have the right ideology. But they're at least out in the community. I hope that, you know, if I would shudder if nobody from African American was representing some form of Islam. But at least they're out there. We're not even inviting people to our facility. That's why it's my hope and prayer that you all will get together with other similar situated people in New Haven and Hamden, other places, and open up activities. So let these guys who are not doing anything, let them just die in those centers. You know, they say something's wrong when you have more janazas than you have weddings, more janazas than you have shahada tanks. Something's wrong. No program.
Yeah.
I would shudder today if I were a young person. I was a 16-year-old, and I was looking for a religion. I certainly wouldn't shop at one of our places.
Yeah.
There's sentence of death. I'm sorry to make that indictment. I don't want to drag you into this as a journalist, but that's just my observation. And I know Ixon Bagdi, I was just with him in Maine. Actually, he was at the Hartford Seminary while I was there. He came later. But I'm appalled. I hope you would join me and others, and we need to do a study of this decline. I think we're being very frank. You know, you go to the community, and all you see is a bunch of gray-bearded men and dried-up people. And they don't even bring their children to the places. That's what bothers me. Now, I do see hope. I see hope. I must tell you that last year's Muslim convention, we had a large number of young people, had a contingency, and I'm going to increase it. I'm in making a challenge to the Muslim community that if we can come, I plan to at least, I'm starting right now. We want to bring at least 10,000 people to the convention in Chicago.
Yeah.
Look, that's the only coming point. Let's have that then from there, let's spring out. And in these cities, all the activists, the D-Shahid Kareem, get married to the other D-Shahid Kareem. And let's transform these centers. I mean, we need places where people can get GED. Even if we don't have professional counseling, we can have coaching. We can coach people. We can have workshops. We can have, you know, a peace workshop. This is what our ministry is all about. We're not here to stay in the message. We're not here like another network, talk just to Muslims 3 hours. We just in a self-congratulatory spoken session. You know, that's what I see most of us doing. We happy to see 10 people. I'm depressed to see 10 people. I really am. I said, but the greatest message in the world. What the hell I look at on before 10 people?
Yeah.
I don't know
where
these people get this from. Can you comment on that? Or I was asked again in the vernacular. What's up with that?
Yeah, I think that we're not organized. A lot of our massages and Islamic centers are not organized. We can't hold enough energy in our centers to do the things that we need to do to make, you know, our contribution to our communities. So lack of organization hurts us, and we go back to the point where young people who are professionals who are trying or want to try to do something in their community, they don't have the opportunity to do it, and that, and I go back to that hurts us, man. It hurts us because folks, there are young Muslims people younger than me who are more qualified than a lot of folks in our masjid, want to utilize their services for the benefit of the community, but can't, for whatever reason, but can't. So they take their services, they take their services and expertise elsewhere. I think if we open the doors to more of our young people, allow our young people to take the helm of leadership in our communities, we'll be much, much better, much further than where we are. Until that happens, you're going to see a slow, steady decline in African-American in mosques around the country. And that's just reality. That's where it is. And you mentioned it. It's a bunch of, you know, gray-beard men that are sitting in our communities. We come for Jumu'ah on Friday. We may have a Talim service on Sunday. We may have a class on Tuesday, Thursday, and that's it. No
anybody's attending both. I think all of our massages up and down the East Coast together don't have 2,000 people.
And we have to really look at other ways to fundraise. These chicken dinners, these barbecues, these events that we have, you know, don't raise enough money for us to sustain ourselves for 5 years. That should be our goal. We should look at a 5-year goal at least.
You know what I want to share with you, Brother D. Shahid Kareem? I want to share with the audience that I'm working to remedy that situation. First of all, we intend to start Jumu'ah on the web so the young people that can't participate or don't want to go to these places can hear a progressive 21st century khutbah. And we have, I want to share with you and the audience that every first Sunday we focus on education. Second Sunday we focus on business. Third Sunday we focus on the culture. Fourth Sunday we focus on government. We should have a curriculum in our center. So I'm hoping that brothers like you, sisters like you, will join with me and let us form an association within association where we can get together energetic people. I hope to be the only old person in there. But I'm here to mobilize the young people. All I want to do is pass down to you all my historical experience. But I want you all to take the ball and run with it. You know, I want you all, meanwhile, we can mobilize. I want to see in New Haven, in Hartford, in Bridgeport, towns that I know that I have found here, open up new centers and reach out to the African-American people. Period. That should be our targeted audience. You know, to hell with all this interface stuff. We already got that down. Let's go out and talk to Dr. Jones. Let's talk to Keisha. Let's talk to Ray Ray. Let's talk to Pookie. Pookie can become Dr. Pookie. Ray Ray can become Attorney Raymond. You see, Keisha can put on a kimura. You know, second thing I think you're so right in saying, why don't we raise big, why don't we, all the regions get together and have a big concert? You know, let's have something big. We need to have big events. And I'm going to let you in on a secret. I may be old, but I'm telling you, I'm starting a television business. We hope by next year this time to be on television. My competition is not with Imam Kuhu or Imam Beanfire, that 10 people in this place. I'm competing with Prepo Dollar, with T.D. Jakes. Numbers do matter. I don't care what nobody says. A lot of us just make excuses. And we'll say, well, you know, numbers is quality. It's not quantity. No, that's a lie. Imam Muhammad said that too. He said, yes, you need to have big numbers. You definitely need to have big meetings. What in the hell wrong with you? You got a facility. You ain't saying nothing. Nobody comes. People have already voted with their feet that they don't support you. And that's all over the United States. You know, it ain't New Haven. It ain't Irvington, New Jersey. We just had a center close up. I don't particularize. You know, every time I had a discussion with Imam Muhammad about these places, he always said to me, that's how they all are.
Yeah.
He also warned that I think you were at the 2007 Ramadan session.
Yeah.
And he said that the people that are coming on after me, these young people that are with me, He said, they're going to invite you to go outside, and they're not going to talk tea and coffee. And I see a new day coming, Brother D. Shahid Kareem. I detect in you and a lot of other people that you all are tired of this old regime of, you know, two chicken burgers, type fundraising, old place where you got 10 people, the person standing on the door, look like he's about to fall off from diabetes. And the other person in the Treasury Department, he'd been right, he'd tell you about what happened 50 years ago. But hasn't invited anybody. And if you do invite somebody to these places, they'll fall asleep because it's not relevant.
Yeah. There, you know, there's some value into the experience and the information that our pioneers have. There is value.
It's a lot. But it shouldn't be put as in a form of anesthesia. I have accused the imams here, rather tongue-in-cheek and actually truthfully. I said these imams have put on the people something worse than what Dr. Murray put on Michael Jackson. You know, you say he put propofol. Well, they put something worse. They put the people in a deep coma, you know. And I think our people are suffering from a real, you know, rip-down wrinkle effect because they're not being accurate. No, I'm very much for the past. I mean, every time I give a lecture, I take us all the way back to the past, but I bring us up to the present. What's going on in Dixwell? And don't think the New Haven is the only town that this is going on in. This is I can tell you, this is a universal phenomenon.
Yeah.
Among our community. Yeah, it's a stagnation.
Yeah. And we have to have these candid and open conversations within
our
community.
Yes, we do. We have to. Yes, we do. We can never talk about developing. One of the biggest states of African Americans as a group is denial. And the Muslim community, we are full of denial. We just have a lot and lot of denial. So if you'd like to join the conversation, we have about 14 more minutes here. You can join the conversation by just pressing 1 if you're already on the line. And if you're listening by browser, just dial 805-727-7013. Brother D. Shahid Kareem is with us, and we have about 8 minutes. Please forgive me, Brother D. Shahid. You got me to get the Holy Ghost, and I stopped talking. I don't usually talk on these programs. I like to hear from them. But I am seriously concerned to hear from a young man under 50 that came in the community in 95. And I think that's something, because we experienced a great growth between 75, 95. It just seems that people come out to listen to Imam Muhammad, but they wouldn't come out to listen to the rest of these people. What's up with that, Brother? Why would they would listen to Imam Muhammad, and then they would when he leave town, they wouldn't come and listen to these other guys?
I really don't know, Brother Alfred.
You're a journalist. I'm not going to hold you to it. I won't give you a grade. It won't be a part of your community psychology class. Your internship, you're going to get an A. Anyway, so go ahead and just share with your ideations, as we would say in psychology.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of stuff is just political. It's political. It's power. And media is a source of control over power, wealth, and information. So we have those similar dynamics in our community. We have people who want to be have control over the power, the wealth, and the information. So a lot of times, folks are not going to be willing to sit down and listen to other folks because they're not the ones that are doing the talking. They're not the ones that have the wealth, or they're not the ones that have the information. So when you have that dynamic, you really put a divide, within our community, and it hurts our interests in the long run. We talk about we need to come together. We talk about the collective interest or the collective body, and everybody says that. But I think one of the biggest challenges that we face is, are we looking at the mirror and seeing and looking at, is it me am I the one that's dividing the community? Am I the one that has an ego problem? You know, am I the one who's always seeking to be top heavy or always seeking to be the one in power? So we have to look at those things and kind of be honest with ourselves and ask ourselves before we speak, well, we need to work together. Am I the cause of the divide within our community? And that's something that a lot of folks just can't do. We have to do that to grow and to heal.
And I also wanted to ask you, what about this idea that a lot of these imams have come around with this idea, imam for life? What's up with that?
Imam for who?
That they are imam for life.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's something that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told him that, you know,
He didn't tell him that, because I'll tell you why I know he didn't tell him that, because he sat a lot of them down. When they were no longer productive, he retired them or got rid of them. They were summarily shown the door. They were relieved of their posts when they were not productive. The Honorable Muhammad paid close attention to your numbers and your productivity. So I know a lot of ministers who had my temples and end up losing them. So the imam didn't give it to them. The Honorable Muhammad didn't give it to them. I think they gave it to themselves.
Yeah, well, I blame that on
the people. That's what I was going to ask you. What is wrong with our people? Just accept anything. No ratification, no votes. They know the places are dying. They know the people don't have any relationship. They don't do anything to reach out to the people. Why is it that our people are people to just tolerate anything?
And that's the community's fault. It's the community's responsibility to select or elect, you know, who they want to lead them. And it could be a variety of reasons. It could be fear. It could be status quo. It could be when someone new comes into office, they can lose their position. It can be being chastised, you know, from the roster, doing Jumar, doing Talim, or being ostracized from coming into the community. There's a lot of reasons, you know, why the status quo is still in place. But ultimately, the community, the strong people in the community have to come together and say, this is enough. That's the only way it's going to change. Unless the strong people in the community say, this is enough, or begin to establish their own, it's not going to change. Going to be the same. It's not going to change.
I agree with you. It we have to see it as our community. These messages are not owned by us. I mean, not owned by, when I say us, the imams. It's owned by the people. The believers are responsible. You know, it seems to me that there's more democracy in these churches. You go into one of these churches, I can tell you that I grew up as a young preacher. They would show you the door in a minute. You know, sometimes justly, sometimes unjustly. But the people saw themselves as holding the pastor responsible. Some I know that have been abusive.
Yeah.
We just don't vote. We let people take our buildings. We let people put their names on the building. We let people do what they want with the building. Once they get in, they become a god in person.
Yeah.
So give us a closing remark. We've certainly enjoyed this. And just see, let me check the board, see if anybody wants to make any comments. But give us a closing statement, Brother Deshai Kareem from the Muslim Journal, now the New Haven Register. I was going to ask you about your future at the New Haven Register, but I won't. But just give us a closing statement.
Yeah. Again, you know, as our influence grows, I also think our level of responsibility should go too. Media is responsible for the information that we see and that we hear, but also media creates images of us, and sometimes it defines our community. So I would encourage those who are looking to go into media, look at it from an avenue of an activism. Because it's an amazing platform to really do some great things in communities, not just within the Muslim community, but all across America.
Let me ask you this. What articles are you working on now? Are you writing any other articles for the Muslim Journal?
Yes, I am actually working on two articles for Muslim Journal. One, this whole conversion to Islam, the whole deterioration of the urban mosque. I'm working on an article now. And I'm also working on the article of how the study of Al-Islam came about. There's a Sunday program that the Nation Mosque puts on every Sunday where they have guest speakers come on and study or review some of the tenets of Islam. So I'm developing those two stories. So those are things I'm currently working on now.
I hope you will do a story on the Religion Means Alive and let people know that we are on the air and been on the air as of the 19th of this month for 3 years. Wednesday will be our third year on the air. We're not affiliated with American Muslim 360. We're the independent brand, and we believe that we are the social brand of Imam Muhammad's community. We're the social face of that community. We're concerned about the problems that our people face. I make no apologies, no hesitation, no intrepidation. I'm a 1,000% supporter of Mosque Care. I support the first Sunday. I support the Savior's Day. I support the Ramadan sessions. I support the conventions. I hope to be one of the biggest inviters to the convention this year. I hope to have, by the end of this February, a cash prize to the person that brings registers the most people for the convention. Time for us to have some big, huge meetings. I'm hoping to see us in the next year. I have a big meeting in New Jersey, big meeting in Connecticut. I think it would affect our people. It would re-energize them. If we need energy. We need a lot. We need a big meeting. That's how I heard from D. Chaid Kareem. Let's hear from young people. Let's hear from the Ismael Kadars. Let's hear from those people. Let's also even hear from our young African-American Christians. Let them come in the form. We want to dialogue. Let's dialogue with them. Let's hear from them. We'd not be ashamed to open up our platforms to others. We've opened up our platform to Dion Walton is going to come on the show. What's his name? Big Daddy Kane. You know, I don't share Big Daddy Kane's views. I probably don't share a lot of the views of Dionne Warwick, but I want to dialogue with her. One brother asked me, what do you have to talk to her about? Oh, she's a human being, right? She's an African-American, right? She's a person of faith, right? Oh, I have a hell of a lot to care about her. You know, she grew up in religion. I grew up in religion. She's a great singer. I happen to admire her. So that's what I have to talk about. I ain't got to say, I tell my like, well, I'm going to do a back out to everybody. I have to be an addicted person to a whole lot of rituals, you know. The ritual should inform me. It should not deter me from relating to humanity, particularly my own people. So with those words, we thank our dear brother. We certainly are not out of message. This brother has inspired me to have more, or influenced me, rather. We're only inspired by God, but we are influenced by each other.
Mm-hmm.
You see a young man. You are under 50, aren't you?
Yes, sir, 41.
Wow. You know I have a son I have a son that's now 42, entering 43. I have a 41-year-old son. I'm so proud of you. I almost really say son, but I don't want you to ever take it if I said son that I'm putting you in some subordinate position. I think you as an equal to come into the leadership. And I've observed you over maybe 10 to 12 years. And I really see the fruition. I watched you and seeing your growth. You probably met me before. I always make it my business when I see a new face in this community to meet them. That's another thing we stopped doing. We're not a warm place. We don't welcome people. You know, I would shudder to go to one of our centers if I didn't know anybody. Wherever I hold a meeting, I'm going to have good, smiling hostess. To greet people. Hi, brother. How are you, brother? Peace be on you, brother. We welcome you to our meeting. We need to get that. And I believe we will raise our people by the hundreds of thousands, if not the millions, when we have that kind of spirit, that determination, that will to invite them to truth. I mean, we're not here to force them. No. And we hope to come to New Haven with the Muslim Journal and with Imam Muhammad's material and sell it right down the street. I'll come right up on Dickwill Avenue and sell it right on the street. I'm known to open up a bag of tapes and books and sell them.
Yeah.
You know, I went into town recently and I didn't know anybody. And I sold them one of a DVD average. I said, what should I buy? I said, because God himself has a message for you from Imam W.D. Muhammad. He said, I don't know. He didn't know who Imam Muhammad was. I said, you ever heard of Malcolm X? He said, yes. I said, that's Malcolm's teacher. Have you heard of Minister Bulls Farrakhan? That was his teacher. Have you heard of Muhammad Ali? That was his teacher. All of these men have been taught. Now, of course, Brother Farrakhan, I told him he dropped out of the class. I stayed in the class. So,
yeah.
You know, we minister even to the dropouts. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You have listened once again to another edition of Religion Means a Lot. Tomorrow we're going to have the great Murad Muhammad, the greatest promoter of all time, followed by Wednesday, a psychotherapy program with Brother Nazim Rashid. And Friday Thursday will be healthcare day. Friday will be Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam from the great city of Selma, Alabama, former legislator, law professor, president of the city council of Selma, Alabama. He will discuss the news. Saturday, I will come back with an open forum. Sunday, I will give a lecture. Organization is a necessity to get the Quran. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means a Lot. Thank you, Brother D. Shahid Kareem.